Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Welcome, listeners, to another Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is David Watkins, DJW, and I'm here with our guest, Greg Earhart. Greg Earhart is an assistant professor of civil engineering at the University of Kentucky. And Greg has been doing some research. I've been looking over some of his papers. We'll have a link with this to a New York Times article that discussed, or was it the Washington Post? No, I don't remember.
The New York Times.
It was the New York Times. Yes, New York Times article discussing some of his team's research and findings on a number of interrelated issues of interest to me. Some listeners may remember I did a podcast a couple of years ago with Rob talking about the decline in transit ridership, the potential causes, the implications of that. Greg's research also veers in, looks at the various effects of the rise of transportation network companies, TNCs, which listeners probably know as Uber and Lyft. So I want to go ahead and just start. Thanks for coming on. I wanted to go ahead and just start with a general question. In my less informed, more lay approach to the question of the decline in transit ridership that's been going on since, I think we pinpoint it typically starting around 2014. Does that sound about right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely. So first of all, it's a pleasure to be here. I'll let you finish your sentence, but it peaked in about 2014.
Yeah. Okay, great. I want to hear your thoughts on what are some of the leading sort of potential causes? What are the sort of most likely culprits in your view for this? And then we'll look at what your research says about a few of them, but start with what the general most likely causes.
Yeah, so thank you for having me, David. It's a pleasure to be here. And to set the context here, what we're looking at is public transit ridership. Total public transit ridership in the United States peaked in the year 2012, actually. Okay. Bus ridership peaked in 2012. Rail ridership peaked a couple of years later in 2014. And when you look at sort of pre-pandemic conditions, sort of ending in 2018, things are way down during COVID, of course, but transit ridership was already going down before then. Bus ridership was down about 15% in U.S. cities between 2012 and 2018. Rail ridership was down about 3%. And it was down, I think, 4 or 5% from its 2014 peak. And this is surprising. This is surprising for a couple of reasons, because normally when we see transit ridership declines, it's correlated with the recession. Fewer people driving to and from work means fewer people riding transit. This is a period where the economy is strong. It's also a period in which the transit agencies have been expanding service. So it's kind of surprising to see a decline during both a strong economy and service expansion. And so there's been really a lot of speculation as to why that might be. And some of the things, some of the candidates that have been thrown out there as potential contributors, gas prices are lower over that period. Some of the major systems, New York has had, New York subways have had reliability issues, as had the Washington Metro. They had sort of shutdowns for track maintenance and this sort of stuff. You've got sort of questions about does gentrification displace transit ridership by pushing sort of the relatively low-income people who are more reliant on it out into the suburbs, which are harder to serve with transit. Those are some of the big ones. And then there's sort of also questions about, as the economy is strong, do people with more income buy more cars and therefore are less reliant on taking transit places? So all of these things are potential factors and potential contributors. You also have rises in telecommuting over this period. And then you have the introduction of several new modes of transportation that weren't there before. So in this period, you had bike share systems proliferated in a lot of cities. You had the e-scooters come right at the end of that period, virtually overnight. And you have the ride-hailing companies, the Uber and Lyft, and those new modes are potential contributors. So the question here is really, what mix of those things is causing this decline and contributing to this decline?
Great. So the research I've been looking at focuses quite a bit on the TNCs in particular. And so I wanted to share with you my own theory. I no longer hold this theory for your research and other reasons, pushes me further and further away from it. But back when Uber and Lyft were really just kind of starting out and really starting to grow, I had what was something of a heterodox theory. Long-time readers may remember a few blog posts about this, maybe 2013 or 2014. And my theory, which was I was overconfident in clearly because it was wrong, was that the rise in TNCs would lead to perhaps an increase in transit ridership. And my theory was essentially this. I had in mind what I would call a marginal car owner, right? Someone in a place like Seattle, which is a good transit city, but not a great transit city, right? Not a transit city that allows a lot of people to give up their cars. But this marginal car owner would be someone who commutes to work by transit or bike or bus or something, or walking or something, who lives in a transit rich area and can do many of their errands without a car. But who really does need a car for 10 to 20% of their, trips. But because they own a car, perhaps they use a car for 30 to 50% of their trips just because they've already paid for the whole car, right? So it's convenient to do so. So insofar as my theory was that these people, especially given that, taxi service in Seattle had been just, notoriously awful and getting worse. And there was the cap on the number of cabs, the number of medallions had not risen with population and demand. And so, cab service was fairly useless for a lot of people. I thought, well, this could be the thing that helps marginal car owners become non-car households, which will lead to more transit ridership because they won't use TNCs for every single trip, right? They'll start using, and it looks like by and large, well, individual pieces of that theory may have some truth to them. It didn't add up to what I hoped it would or expected it might. What went wrong? What was wrong with my theory in your?
Okay, so I mean, I think it's. A reasonable theory, and you weren't alone in that theory. There were others who argued much the same thing that, and there is value, there's very real value. Owning a car, you have a large sunk cost and you pay a small marginal cost, and that small marginal cost potentially incentivizes people to drive more. And so, yes, there is this idea that by enabling ride-hailing use that people may choose to own fewer cars. The problem is that just isn't borne out by the data. We've got, 2012 or so, Lyft was founded, Uber was 2010. It's been a number of years since then. Car ownership has barely changed when you look at the data. So it just simply isn't a big enough effect to happen. What's really interesting about that, though, is when you start to look into the data, particularly in some of the developing worlds, and I'll hear anecdotally that there's a number of the drivers who will be out there and use driving for Uber or Lyft or a ride-hailing company as a means or an entry into purchasing a car. So they might not make a lot of money as a driver, but they've got a car that they can then use for other activities and so forth. So there's this sort of difference between the driver side and the passenger side that happens. But for the most part, I think what we're seeing is that there's just sort of a long-term baked-in life cycle thing. And the market or the people that are most likely to want to use this are people who maybe rely on public transit, on walking, on biking in the first place, and who then say, well, it takes a lot longer to take the bus. I can take an Uber for this trip instead. Let me do that. If I've got my car, And if I'm going someplace where parking is easy, the incentive is to just drive my own car. If I'm going specifically where it's difficult to park, then it's a very different trade-off. So one really good way to think about a ride hail is the trade-off between paying to park your vehicle where it's difficult to park and paying someone to drive that vehicle away so you don't have to pay to park and let someone else take it.
Yeah. Yep. That makes good sense. Thank you. I wanted to ask you, and I feel like I've heard about problems of this sort coming up for other researchers as well. In some of your research, you mentioned that it's a real challenge in trying to study the impact of TNCs. It's a real challenge to get the data you need, right? The sort of granular data about trips. And if you could talk a little bit about what are some of the obstacles to getting that data? Is it that Uber and Lyft are just sort of unwilling for various reasons to make it available to researchers, or are there other obstacles? And how have you gone about sort of getting around your data problems?
Yeah. Okay, so there's, yes, it is a challenge. What we'd really like to know and understand this is how many people are using these, where are those trips occurring, when are they occurring? So one of the, typically in transportation analysis, what we do is we conduct household travel surveys. We go and we ask a sample of individuals, where did you go yesterday and how did you get there? And we record their locations and so forth. Traditionally, this is done in a diary format, a paper diary. More recently, it's done sort of with a smartphone app that maybe also sort of tracks your GPS coordinates. And those may happen in most cities, maybe every 10 years or so. So a new mode that's actually a relatively small portion of the population, a relatively small portion of total number of trips, is actually hard to capture in a meaningful way using our traditional methods there. So then we're faced with sort of looking at different strategies for what else we can do. And we've actually approached this two different ways in my own research. One is to use market entry as a proxy for ridership and look at the changes across different cities, some of which have Uber and Lyft service and some of which do not. And what this does is it allows us to compare trends in transit ridership among those cities pre-Uber and Lyft to post-Uber and Lyft and control for other things that are changing, such as the gas prices, changes to population and employment, changes to the service provision, and so forth, and actually estimate out the contribution of each. The other strategy that we've used, and this is in partnership with the San Francisco County Transportation Authority, who's very interested in this question. It's the home of these companies, home of the tech industry, early adopter, of much of the technology. And anecdotally, they've been all over the place and the city officials wanted to know and understand how it is affecting the transportation system. And so they wanted ridership data from Uber and Lyft. And this sort of predates my involvement, but the city and the county officials requested it. And they were denied that data. They also requested it from the California Public Utilities Commission. And this is actually an interesting thing. So in California, the TNC Transportation Network Company is a regulatory term that was created. And they're regulated at the state level by the CPUC, the Public Utilities Commission. They're actually required to report data on all of their trips to the CPUC. So CPUC has these data. To my knowledge, they're not using them for anything. And actually, the city actually requested these data through a public records request from the state. And the state said, no, it's not in the public interest for us to give these over. So, I mean, I think there's a couple of things here. There is a legitimate privacy concern, and there is a need to protect the privacy of individual users. There is, however, also a public interest in understanding the effect on the system. And those things aren't mutually exclusive. You can, for example, aggregate the data to census tracts report it at that level. You get a pretty good idea of the patterns without being able to identify anyone. There's a couple of cities that require that and actually report those data publicly. New York, Chicago, I believe Toronto also has some reporting requirement as well. But that's relatively rare. In California, the city has not been able to get those data in spite of sort of repeated efforts to do so. What they did after sort of running into a wall in sort of asking and requesting the data is they actually hired some computer scientists from Northeastern University who wrote a computer program that sort of mimics the call your smartphone makes to the Uber and Lyft servers. And so if you open up the app, you can see it shows you on the app vehicles driving around. And it actually shows you the 10 closest vehicles that are available to be given a ride, basically. And they set it up for a period of 6 weeks in 2016 in a grid across the city, sort of putting in these requests every few seconds. And what that is, that generated, it was like 14 terabytes worth of data, some incredible amount of data. But what you get is you get basically a bunch of GPS traces of where the available vehicles are. And from those data, you can go in and you can see a particular driver. I think one of the companies had a persistent driver ID. You could see it on the map. It'd stop, fall off the map. And then it'd show up 10 minutes later in another part of town. And you can infer that what happened is, okay, at that point, the driver accepted a ride. Right. They went and picked someone up, delivered them to their destination. After they delivered them to their destination, they turned the app back on and were available for another ride. So we were able to use those data to infer where the trips were and use that as the basis for a more detailed analysis in San Francisco of the effects of these on public transit ridership in San Francisco and on traffic congestion in San Francisco.
Great. So that leads very nicely to my next question, which is, let's just sort of talk about some of your big findings here. What have you found the impact of the rise of TNCs to be on transit ridership in general? And then, you know, maybe say something about the difference between its impact on light rail and buses.
Yeah. So let me start with our findings specific to San Francisco. And first, the thing is setting a little bit of context. What we observe in the data that we do have is that the number of ride hail trips are very concentrated in the bigger cities in the US. Something like 70% occur in the seven largest metro areas. And within those metro areas, when you look at the data, they're very concentrated in sort of the downtown cores and the city centers. Okay, so what we were able to do is relate that to sort of where transit ridership was changing and where congestion was increasing. And so we found between 2010, before TNC showed up, and 2016, when they represented about 15% of trips within the city of San Francisco, which is about 12 times the number of taxis in San Francisco. So a lot more ride hailing than taxis. We found that bus ridership, they contributed to a net decline of about 10% in bus ridership. And what that net decline means is bus ridership was actually flat over this period, but based on how much population employment grew and how much service increased, you would have expected it to go up about 10%. It had no significant effect on light rail ridership within San Francisco. And then when you look at traffic congestion, we can measure traffic congestion in a couple of ways, by total vehicle miles traveled. You can measure it by vehicle hours traveled, and you measure by delay. Delay is sort of how much extra time I spend because there's traffic than if I could drive full speed the whole way there. We found that over this period, about traffic congestion or vehicle hours of delay went up about 60% in San Francisco. About half of that was due to population and employment growth. It was a booming city over this time. And the other half was due to the entry of Uber and Lyft into the system.
Why do you think, if you speculate a little on why the impact on light rail was so much less, or perhaps non-existent?
Yeah. Okay. So I think there's a couple of things going on here. I think a big part of it is, and I think there's two things I would point to. One is trip length, and then the second is going to be travel time competitiveness. So the thing about rail is it tends to serve longer trips. Within San Francisco, a typical Uber trip was, I think, about 2.5 miles, which is pretty comparable to an average local bus trip, which also tends to be pretty short. So I think they're kind of natural substitutes in that way. The rail, on the other hand, the trips are longer, and you end up having to pay more in fare just to sort of compensate for that. And in addition, rail tends to have an advantage where it often is grade separated. Maybe it's a subway, it can bypass the traffic. And so there's some travel time advantage that the buses can't offer.
That makes sense. That's what I was thinking. Great, thank you. You look in a couple of your papers, I can see that you're incorporating a little bit of price sensitivity in your thinking about how people make their choices for particular trips. Obviously, that's a big part of the story because of the sunk costs. You pay so much of the cost of any kind of car trip up front that influences how those decisions are made. And this got me to thinking. It's sort of generally understood and well known that TNC and that's both the major TNC companies operate at substantial losses and are currently kind of being funded by venture capital with some sort of future profitability in mind. And I'm wondering, and this goes beyond what your research findings, but do you think that the rise of TNCs, the impact of TNCs, how much of that is tied to a sort of subsidy that those riders and those trips are getting from the operating losses? And would their competitiveness perhaps diminish if at some future date these companies were trying to operate on a profitable basis in the short term rather than their long-term strategy now?
Right. So clearly price matters. And in transportation, we often talk about sort of the value of time. How many dollars am I willing to trade off to save an hour or 30 minutes or 10 minutes of travel time? So that's kind of the key metric here. Clearly it does matter. It is, I think, a little speculative to sort of say how much it matters on the ride-hail side, in part because that's data that we don't have. That's data that we weren't able to collect. And I mean, obviously, each of the companies themselves has their own data, but they, I think the pricing mechanism changes. It changes depending on demand. It changes depending on promotions. So it's not necessarily a constant price, if you will. And then what it's going to be in the future is also a little difficult to predict. There is some reason to think, well, maybe it would be higher if the investors say, okay, now it's time to start sort of turning a profit. On the other hand, we have the potential of automated vehicles on the horizon. And Uber and Lyft are very much sort of invested in that, as are several new competitors. You have several new companies, Waymo, for example, and Cruise and a few others, who are specifically dedicated to operating self-driving cars. You can go to Phoenix now and pay to take a ride. In California, they're being tested on the roads, but they're not yet authorized for commercial permits. So then there's this question, well, if you don't have to pay the driver, does it then become a cheaper ride in the future? So there's some potential for that as well. The economics of it, I'm not really sure on, because what's the trade-off of having to buy the vehicle versus having to pay the driver? So what's going to happen isn't clear. It clearly does make a big difference in as far as what we know of how people behave already.
Yes, thank you. I really do wonder if the technology continues to advance and automated cars become this widespread thing, are they going to be able to retain their market share in the face of that development? Right, that seems to me to be a pretty big open question.
Are Uber and Lyft be able to retain their market share? Yeah. I would view the automated vehicle companies. Well, there's a few strategies, but the ones who are focused on fleet service to be direct competitors with Uber and Lyft. So I would expect that to be the case. Now you have Tesla is focused on selling people cars, and they also are working on self-driving technology. Some of the automakers, they don't care about operating the service. They just want to make cars and sell people cars. And that's a different thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I guess I want to draw out one kind of thing for you to talk about from your research. And then I have kind of a couple of questions to close about policy implications of all this. But based on your San Francisco studies, share with our listeners a little bit about the estimates you are able to come up with in terms of what kind of numbers are we talking about in terms of TNC's effect on transit ridership.
Okay, so let me answer that in the context of a national study that we have coming out shortly. And this is from a Transportation Research Board sponsored project, the Transit Cooperative Research Program, looking at exactly this question. And what we found when we looked at it, we were able to partition out the bus ridership and the rail ridership across about 250 metro areas in the U.S. And we were able to look at how it differs for big, medium, and small cities. The losses are occurring on the bus side across all city sizes. Mm-hmm. On the rail, it's interesting. It's a bit different between some of the smaller cities and some of the larger cities. Mm-hmm. But what we find overall of this 15% bus ridership decrease, transit service expansion and land use changes would suggest that it should increase about 5%. Mm-hmm. Fare changes reduce ridership. Some fares have gone up, particularly in some of the smaller cities. They reduce ridership a couple of percent. Gas prices are down from about $4 in 2012 to a little over $2 in 2018. That leads to about a 4% net reduction. Changes to in higher income, changes to working from home, changes to car ownership, about 1 to 2%. And then competition with ride hailing is about a 10% net reduction in bus ridership. And this is across all city sizes. So this is happening not just in the big cities, but everywhere. When you look at rail, it's a little interesting. The sort of medium-sized cities, smaller medium-sized cities, some of the new rail systems, we find a reduction there as well of about 10% less ridership attributable to ride hailing. But we don't see that in the biggest cities, the New Yorks, the Chicagos on rail. And this, I think, goes back to this question about use of the system. Maybe there's a travel time advantage bypassing congestion in these subway systems that's going to happen, lets those systems be a little bit more resilient mm-hmm. than in the smaller cities.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, that makes good sense. I wanted to just sort of close by asking if you were to think about the findings of this body of research, if you were to be giving advice to city level politicians or to directors of transit agencies who have a commitment to, increasing ridership and decreasing car use and congestion for a variety of reasons, climate change and general quality of life in the cities and so on and so forth. But at the same time, looking around in North America in particular, it seems that efforts to just simply ban TNCs are just kind of politically unstable, right? I know Austin did it for a while. I think Vancouver, BC did it for a while. I think Portland did it very briefly. And I just, it just seems to be too unpopular to sustain. That's my sense of that. So short of simply banning them, how would you kind of advise politicians to approach this problem in ways that sort of reduce the harms that they cause to transit ridership as well as congestion?
Yeah. So I think a couple of things. No one I know is talking about banning ride hailing. That's not a meaningful part of the discussion that I've seen. Mm-hmm. I think there's a recognition that that they play a role, and I think there's a recognition that there's some trade-offs here. There are clear benefits. People are using them because they're convenient. They're relatively cheap. They give you door-to-door service, and so there's a real benefit to the person in that vehicle. There is at the same time some external cost borne by other people in the form of traffic congestion, in the form of added pollution, and so on and so forth. And it is much like driving your personal car. I can drive my car and it's good for me and I have some effect on other people. So how do you sort of value or maximize the good and minimize the bad is really the discussion. And when I'm speaking specifically to transit operators, I think it's important, and to the view of transit in general, I think it's important to keep in mind the motivations and the sort of fundamental goals of public transit. And there's two things. One of them, I think, as you alluded to, is about carrying people in a space-efficient way. Right. So I can fit more people on a bus than I can in cars. And so especially in the dense corridors, they're efficient in terms of traffic congestion. They're efficient in terms of getting a lot of people through in a way that cars aren't in general. The second, though, is providing a service and providing transportation to the people who need it most. So one of the things that we've seen during COVID is that as stay-at-home orders have been in place, public transit ridership has been way down. But it is down the most in like central business districts where there's a lot of office workers, places like that. In low-income areas, in minority areas, in places where you have a lot of essential workers, nurses, grocery store workers, so on and so forth, those are people who are still going to work and who maybe don't have a car and rely on public transit to get to work. And so even in the face of low ridership, public transit continues to operate as an essential service and not necessarily in a profit maximizing or ridership maximizing way, in a way that's saying, okay, we've got a public service role in providing this service. So I think it's really important to keep in mind those sort of dual goals here as we sort of think about the value of it. Now, obviously they want riders back. That helps generate fare revenue, that helps reduce car traffic, that helps them pay the bills. And that's an important part of the deal. And what we need to be thinking about there is simply incentives, travel time and cost. So you can look for example at the city of Chicago. City of Chicago has implemented a ride hail fee. And it is structured in such a way that it's a low fee if you take a shared ride, a higher fee if you book a private trip. It's a lower fee if you're in the outlying areas, which are the places that transit, it's harder for transit to serve, and the places that we may want to incentivize the ride hailing to happen. And it's higher if you're going to and from downtown or to the convention center, a few specific places. So you can think about dealing with that in terms of pricing. You can think about it, dealing it in terms of congestion pricing. New York, San Francisco, Seattle, I think, are the ones to come to mind, have proposals for charging cars to come into their downtown core, much like London and Stockholm do now. And then I think broadly beyond that, I think it's an opportunity or chance to rethink how we allocate our right-of-way. So the street is a public space. How much of that public space are we dedicated to people walking? Are we dedicated to parking? Are we dedicated to people biking, to the buses, to the cars? And how we choose to make that allocation, especially in the big cities, it's not expanding. It's a fixed amount of width that I have, but how we choose to allocate that is indicative of what our preferences and what our values are in a way in terms of what we want. And so if you want space efficient in a dense corridor, well, maybe you give one of the lanes to buses and let them bypass the traffic. That makes some difference, for example.
That makes great sense. And I think that's very much speaking my language, that treat it as a public good and think about what we value in how we allocate it. My sense is there's a lot of low-hanging fruit on that front. The experience of the bus lane on 14th Avenue in New York was just so overwhelmingly positive. And that was, what, 2 years ago, I think? That
was pretty recently, yeah. And, I mean, I think there's examples in a number of places. I mean, so Seattle's done a few of them. Indianapolis implemented what they call a bus rapid transit line. It's got a dedicated lane. You pay at the station before getting on the bus, so boarding and alighting is a little more efficient. But basically, things you can do that make the travel time better are things that people are going to appreciate. It's sort of bread and butter things. And I mean, the nice thing about buses is the infrastructure is already there in a lot of ways. You don't necessarily have to build something new. You can think about using the existing in an efficient way.
Mm-hmm. The Indianapolis route is very good. I rode that a couple of times just before the world ended and I stopped riding buses. And that's, looks like a really a fantastic program that they've got going there. One thing interesting here in Dayton that I think was in some part a response to the arrival of Uber and Lyft, they came to Dayton somewhat late, and I think people were a little bit startled at just how much demand there was for them. My understanding is that for a while, a lot of drivers were coming up from Cincinnati. Just there was such mm-hmm. demand here for rides that was worth doing for them. And some of it, by no means all of it, but some of it was the students at my university. You know, they mostly live on campus. It's a fairly compact area, but yes, to get from some dorms to the bar area, it's maybe 20, 25 minute walk. So apparently there's lots of short trips on your Thursday, Friday, Saturday night as they're moving around campus and to the bars and so on. And the local transit agency at that point, I think, was able to convince my employer, as well as a handful of other major employers in the downtown area, to sort of fund this circulator route that goes from downtown and then through the university. You know, it's basically about 2 miles and then 2 miles back. It's free. It runs every 10 minutes. It runs until midnight. I think the transit agency had wanted to do something like that for a while, and the spike in demand for Ubers and Lyfts, I think, sort of helped motivate some of the institutional partners who had to pony up some money to fund this turn around and do it. So that was sort of a potentially interesting local response, a sort of change in service, recognizing where some of what we were learning about demand from Uber and Lyft, and again, very informally, right? We're just sort of observing it, not digging into the data that we don't really have access to. But that was one shift here at Dayton that struck me as a joke. I like it. I use that bus all the time, not in the late night Friday and Saturday when all the drunk kids are on it, but the rest of the time.
No, I mean, I think that's great. And I think that makes sense in terms of thinking about what is the market we're actually trying to serve. And I think the other thing that you kind of hit on, and I think is implicit here, is a lot of what we see in the bus ridership is the late night does matter in a way, mm-hmm. But not just for the people going to the bars and restaurants, but also for the people working at the bars and restaurants. Mm-hmm. Maybe they work a late shift, they need to get home. And that sort of nighttime service providing some way to get home safely when maybe a lot of people don't want to be walking to a bus stop at night is something that's, I think, worth thinking about. Not everyone works a 9 to 5. There's a lot more variability than often we recognize.
Outstanding. Well, thank you very much. Any last final thoughts you want to add before we sign off?
No, I think this is great. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I look forward to hearing more of your podcasts.
Fantastic. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for listening.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.